World News Today, brought to you by Admiral Corporation, in behalf of distributors and dealers all over America and in many foreign lands. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations and leading news centers of our own country, CBS reporters are waiting to bring you first-hand news from the world's political and battlefronts. Now, here's Douglas Edwards.
British troops in Normandy continue to maintain their lines in the Caux sector despite a series of German counterattacks. In Russia, the Germans are falling back on Minsk, and Moscow dispatches say enemy troops are disorganized and are often losing their bearings in the retreat. In the Italian zone, American troops of the Fifth Army have captured the west coast town of Cecina. To the east, three French columns are converging on Siena. American heavy bombers today attacked oil refineries, rail yards, and industrial areas near Budapest and at other points in Hungary and Yugoslavia. Usually reliable Stockholm sources say that German forces have occupied the Åland Islands at the entrance to the Gulf of Bothnia between Sweden and Finland. But Swedish authorities profess to have no knowledge of such a move, and the Finns have denied it. The Free Danish Press Service reports from Stockholm the German occupation forces in Denmark have ringed Copenhagen and announced that all communication with the city has been blocked. We continue our progress on Saipan in the Pacific. Now for our first news direct from overseas, Admiral takes you to Normandy. Bill Downs reporting.
There has been an ominous quiet on the British sector of the beachhead today. The kind of silence that shrieks of big events to come.
It is quieter down on the front today than any time I've heard it since we invaded France. There was only an occasional shell or mortar from the enemy, and there was only spurted shelling from the British battery. Incidentally, the Germans have an extremely difficult time in using their guns and mortars. Every time they open up, special locating devices spot them, and the British counter battery fire is terrific. The hundreds of pounds of hot steel that answer even the fire of one mortar must have the Nazis thinking twice before they fire even a revolver in our direction. Undoubtedly, that is one of the reasons for the comparative quiet around the British wedge today. Another reason is that yesterday the Germans got such a bloody nose in their abortive threat to breach the wedge that they undoubtedly retired to rest and regroup. But let me emphasize, while things may be quiet here today on this front, behind the front, it is a different story. You will learn about that later. British engineers have been training dogs for the past several months to smell out the enemy mines. This is not as ridiculous as it might sound. Dogs have done this type of work very successfully. The German army has used them as well as the Russians. Although they have not been employed on a large scale here, the plan has been successful where the dogs have worked. However, at the training school here in... just about broke up the class the other day. A British truck drove by their school, and they immediately set out after it like a lot of foxhounds. But they were only doing what they had been taught to do. The truck was loaded with British mines on the way to the front. And believe it or not, that story was told to me by a perfectly straight-faced colonel who should know. And this is Bill Downs in Normandy returning you to the United States.
And now for more details on the situation in France, Admiral takes you to CBS London, Richard C. Hotellet reporting.
You've heard Bill Downs from the scene of the fighting on our eastern flank in Normandy. The Germans are also reporting the situation. They say that the British are supported by a steamroller of land and naval artillery fire. And they talk as if the fighting there had not slackened at all. One German correspondent says the enormous tank battle southwest of Caen, which has lasted more than 100 hours, continues with undiminished fury. This same reporter credits the British with having 14 to 16 divisions there. The idea of this propagandistic German reporting would seem to be to justify in advance a possible withdrawal and to squeeze more credit out of delaying our advance. The weather has kept our air activity down to practically nothing at all. So far, the only word is of Fortresses, Liberators, and RAF Lancasters bombing the Doodlebug coast. In the Caen area, though, the Navy has taken over part of the Air Force's job and done it nobly. The battleship Rodney has been throwing 16-inch shells for 18 miles into German concentrations in the Caen area. Each shell is about the equal of a one-ton bomb. Elsewhere on the Normandy front, we have nothing to report in the way of military engagements. The Germans say that American troops were attacking repeatedly yesterday north of Saint-Lô, and say that we're regrouping our forces here as a prelude to a major combined Anglo-American effort. There was word today of the progress being made in restoring the port of Cherbourg. Major General Cecil Moore, chief engineer of the U.S. forces in this theater, reported that the Germans had done an expert job of demolition. He said that they had not been indiscriminate, but had dynamited what would do maximum damage, the longest bridges, key railroad spurs in the port, and the roads and railroads leading out of the city. They sank ships at strategic points in the harbor and left many mines and underwater obstacles. The general said it would be a tough job getting Cherbourg back in working order, a tougher job than we had at Naples. But, he said, we were prepared to tackle it, that we had been preparing as a matter of fact with maps and plans and even scale models of Cherbourg for the past 2 years. I return you now to Admiral in New York.
More news in just a moment, but first here's Warren Sweeney with a message from Admiral Corporation.
Haven't you heard a lot of your friends say, when the war is over, I'm certainly going to own one of these home freezers for quick frozen foods? It seems that nearly everyone has become aware of the goodness of frozen foods and the economy of buying and storing foods in large quantities. The Admiral Home Freezer will do this job so perfectly, with so little trouble and inconvenience, that the demand will probably exceed output for the first few years following the war. The Admiral Home Freezer will provide the means to store large quantities of frozen, fresh foods at zero temperature, practically and economically. You'll enjoy the extra flavor, the extra health, the out-of-season enjoyment, and the lightened kitchen drudgery that only the use of frozen foods can bring. The Admiral Home Freezer will simplify your meal planning, save you many shopping trips, and make it possible to prepare a delicious, well-balanced meal for unexpected guests on a moment's notice. And your Admiral Home Freezer will actually pay for itself in food savings. So plan now to own one of these new ways to finer living from the same great factories that will bring you Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Douglas Edwards.
Our news scene switches to the Pacific, where American troops are still making progress on Saipan. For an interview with a Navy lieutenant who witnessed the recent naval battle in the Marianas, Admiral takes you to CBS Pearl Harbor, Webley Edwards reporting.
Our troops continue to move forward on Saipan and have wiped out several pockets of resistance that were bypassed in previous advances. Our carrier aircraft made still another attack on Rota. Among the first observers of the Saipan and Philippine Sea battle is Navy Lieutenant Jim Britt, former radio man of Boston, who was aboard a United States aircraft carrier in the great victory of June 18th. Jim, will you tell us about it?
Well, Webb, we took battle stations after the word was passed that a tremendous carrier aircraft attack was on the way in. You could tell just by looking at our pilots as they raced to their planes that every man felt this was the chance for which he had waited. Within 30 minutes of launching, we could see long wisps of smoke trailing from Jap planes as they were shot down. Listening to the ship's radio, we could tell our pilots were having a field day. One youngster who had long waited for a crack at the Japs apparently had a zero on his tail, because over the radio we heard him moan, "Oh, Lordy, not the first time. Somebody shoot that blank blank zero down." And another voice calmly said, "Roger," and promptly did so. That was typical of the teamwork. Ensign Wilbur Webb of Ardmore, Oklahoma, shot down a section of three Japs in one run, got six and two probables in his first engagement. Dozens of pilots became aces within half an hour.
How close did the Japs come to your carrier, Jim?
Well, all told, the Japs sent in 10 waves of from 40 to 50 planes each, and of course some got through. But despite the exaggerated Tokyo claims, not one of our ships was seriously damaged. I saw one plane drop a bomb close to our bow, but all it did was irritate our AA gunners who shot him down. A Zero raced across with two Hellcats in pursuit, and the gunner stopped firing while the Hellcat shot the Jap to pieces. Three Jap pilots bailed out off our starboard beam, but there was no time to pick them up. One Jap torpedo bomber caught fire 50 yards ahead of another carrier and roared the whole length of the flight deck, not more than 20 feet overhead, then crashed into the sea. In many cases, the pilots told us the Japs made no attempt to fight back. The rear gunner of one bomber was reported to have folded his guns and his arms and huddled waiting to be killed.
The surprising thing of this great battle, Jim, was its brevity, huh?
Short and sweet, Webb. All our planes got safely back but one. More than 20 Japs had fallen before them. The whole show was a tribute to three outstanding factors: the superiority of our pilots, the excellence of our planes, and the Native American teamwork that these kids had learned from their school days up. The official score, 402 planes to our 26, confirmed what we already knew, that our pilots had scored the greatest aerial victory in the history of naval warfare at a cost which was described by Admiral Mitcher as an unhoped-for minimum.
It was really a knockout, then.
Our planes did such a thorough job of destroying Jap carrier aircraft that we attacked their fleet the next day before replacements could be provided. Of all the actions I've seen, this was the greatest show of them all. On no occasion has the overall superiority of our pilots, planes, and carrier tactics been so evident. Anyone who has seen this Pacific War at first hand knows there's plenty of tough going still ahead. But I still like to remember what one flyer said after the battle. If this is the Jap Air Force, how we'd love to take a crack at Tokyo.
Thank you, Navy Lieutenant Jim Britt, for a swell story of the naval air battles in the Philippine Sea. This is Webley Edwards at Pearl Harbor. I return you to Admiral in New York.
In Finland, Premier Edwin Linkomies told his people today that German war material and other help is necessary for the success of their fight. He said, "It is Finland's self-evident duty to lay down its arms only when a mutual understanding about it exists with Germany." And now, Admiral, takes you direct to CBS Moscow, James Fleming reporting.
The inhabitants of Minsk are today listening to the music of their liberation as they hear the thunder of Red Army artillery approaching the city. That's how Izvestia describes the record Soviet offensive converging on the capital of White Russia. 37-year-old Army General Chernyakhovsky, the youngest commander of his rank in the Red Army, is setting the pace in the race for Minsk. It was his troops who yesterday stormed Borisov, who forced the Berezina River on a 70-mile front, and who now have moved their big guns to within earshot of their goal. From Russian civilians who have slipped through the German lines, we now have the story of life in Minsk under the German occupation. The city was a scene of uninterrupted guerrilla warfare. For 3 years, the Germans have been forced to maintain defenses in the very streets of the city. The German regional commanders traveled in armored cars, kept dogs and special SS guards around their dwellings. Despite these precautions, they were killed by the partisans one after another, including the German governor of all of White Russia. The Battle of Minsk has been going on since June 24, 1941. The city, laid waste during the first German assault 3 years ago, is still a mass of ruins. Its liberation is not many hours away. Moscow has been celebrating these White Russian victories with a record number of victory salutes, with their spectacular displays of fireworks lighting the evening sky and their artillery salvos. Here's how one of those salutes sounds, as picked up from a microphone in Red Square. You'll hear the chimes of the Kremlin clock and the thunder of the big guns.
You have just heard a report from James Fleming in Moscow. The Chinese High Command announces that Japanese planes are dropping showers of incendiary bombs on Hengyang, the encircled city in Hunan province. But the Chinese say their troops are still holding out and the Jap land attack has diminished. Special planes are being used to evacuate American and other foreigners from Kuilin, the capital of Quanxi province, to the southwest. This because of the menace of the double threat of the Jap drive north and south along the Hangkong to Canton Railroad. Usually reliable Stockholm sources said today that the German forces have occupied the Åland Islands at the entrance to the Gulf of Bothnia. The Finns in Stockholm have questioned Foreign Minister Henrik Ramsey of Finland, and he denies that report. The Åland Islands, which have several good harbors, lie approximately 15 miles from the Finnish coast and about 25 miles from the Swedish coast. They are Finnish property. The possibility of German occupation of the islands has been discussed widely in Stockholm for some time. As we told you, Allied armies on the Italian front are still moving up the peninsula on the western side and in the center, chasing the retreating Germans. And now for a summary of this battle, Admiral takes you direct to CBS Rome, Eric Severide reporting.
This is Eric Severide in Rome. Again today, strong forces of liberators and fortresses attacked refineries, factories, and rail yards in Hungary and Yugoslavia. They shot down an unspecified number of enemy planes. But our own losses are not given. To the north, on this front, the enemy continues to fall back. They gave us a hard fight last night in the seacoast town of Cecina. But the men of the Fifth Army took the town, forcing the Germans out house by house. The high command describes this as one of the stiffest Fifth Army fights since the occupation of Rome. There were mines and booby traps everywhere. This advance brings the Americans to within 18 miles of Leghorn, a large Italian port. Along the Adriatic, there is only intermittent contact with the enemy. They are pulling back very rapidly. The French of the Fifth Army continued their converging move upon the old and beautiful city of Siena. Yesterday, they were just 9 miles away. To drive now from South Italy up the long, straight Appian Way is to see a multitude of the little people, the refugees, slowly, wearily, shuffling back toward home. Skinny horses stumble in a shaft of rickety carts piled high with rickety chairs. Barefoot children lead overburdened burros. Adolescents dip their thumbs in the American hitchhike manner. Beside the roadway, you see father and son trying again to patch a tire which will stand no more. When the war reached their homes, we passed them back in trucks under an organized system. Now we have a great refugee problem in reverse, and many do not wait for a system, so the Vatican is doing its best. We took many thousands to Sicily for haven. Now they are filtering back, following the only instinct they know. Home may now be a dusty pile of masonry. It is their own, and it is all they have. Perhaps towns like Cecina or Formia or Ypres will live again. These people have a capacity for patient work, but up to now, little has been done. There is no machinery, no materials, and merely to find food is a daily task. As in all countries at war, it is the very poor in the towns who suffer the most. They had no country villas for refuge. They had no cars and techs to transport their things. It was they who lived by the highways and rail tracks and factories where the war strikes hardest. The rich are all right, and most of the farmers who may lose their walls. But war never really injures the earth. But you see all the ruined old towns and you wonder. In most cases, all the shells and bombs were of little avail in dislodging the enemy, who had to be driven away by infantry or outflanked by them. But the people now standing helpless before the dusty piles betray no signs of resentment. They seem to endure and accept it as they accepted the war, the regime which produced war, and as they accepted defeat. Now back to CBS in New York.
Now for an interview with a Navy officer who was in charge of the combat recording set up in the invasion, Admiral takes you to CBS Washington, Don Pryor reporting.
First, the news from Washington. Norman H. Davis, national chairman of the American Red Cross and a veteran of world diplomacy during the terms of five presidents, died suddenly this morning at Hot Springs, Virginia. Representative Ramspeck of Georgia, the House Democratic whip, announced today that leaders of both parties in Congress have agreed to call a holiday on controversial legislation until after Labor Day. The plan is for congressional leaders to return on the 1st of August and then to adjourn until after Labor Day, or merely to keep renewing a series of three-day recesses. The idea is to give congressmen a chance to get back home and mend their political fences. A young freshman senator who has been coming up fast in Democratic political councils has been picked to be the permanent chairman of the Democratic Convention, which meets in Chicago 2 weeks from next Wednesday. He is Samuel D. Jackson of Fort Wayne, Indiana. On D-Day and during the critical days that followed, you had the better front row seat at the making of history than anybody has ever had before, and this is why. When the invasion ships left England, four American radio reporters went along, each with an engineer and a film recording machine furnished by the Navy. In the height of battle, these reporters described the action as it happened, and their words and the sounds of war were recorded on a tiny roll of film. You heard those recordings by shortwave from London within a few hours after the time they were made. Nothing like such fast eyewitness reporting of war has ever been known before. So to tell you the story behind this invasion reporting, here is Lieutenant Marvin Royston, USNR, who just came back from London. He's an engineer in the radio section of the Navy's Office of Public Relations. He knows that almost human little gadget, the film recorder, very intimately, because he's been working with it for a long time. Isn't that right, Marvin?
Yes, Doyle, since last September.
Was the invasion the first real trial of the recorder?
No, Lieutenant Commander Dillon and I tried it out last year. We made a cruise on an aircraft carrier in the Atlantic, and he made the first combat recordings then.
Well, what was your job in London?
There I trained the network engineers in the use of the recorder and the radio reporters to us, for that matter. In the case of an engineer was wounded, the reporter could have gone right on and run the machine for himself.
Well, how many recorders did you have over there?
We had 16. I assigned two of them to each of the network teams, and I had eight others for broadcasting, dubbing, censorship, and all that.
Well, tell me, how was the film handled? Take Columbia's Charles Collingwood, for instance. He was out on an LCVP over at the beachhead. He described what was going on, and his description was recorded on film. What then?
Well, he would call a dispatch boat, which rushed the film back to England. It was picked up at the dock and hurried to London by motorcycle and sometimes by airplane. We had our control room right in the Ministry of Information. The censors were right there to listen to it, and we dubbed out everything that violated security rules.
What do you mean by dubbing?
I'm afraid that's a little too complicated to explain on the air. It's just the way we eliminate things from a recording and or put things into it.
Okay, we won't go into that. How about your trip that you made with Ed Murrow, CBS's correspondent in London?
Well, I wanted to see some of the show instead of staying at headquarters all the time. So I went with Ed Murrow as his engineer. At first, we were going to fly over the beachhead, but the plane blew out a tire, and we missed that mission. When we finally got into the air, our orders were to bomb launching platforms for the robot planes up near Calais.
Well, now that your film recorders have worked out so well in the big test, what's the plan for the future? There's still a lot of the war to cover.
Yes, and the Navy is going to do everything humanly possible to help you reporters cover it. I believe the recordings will be used more extensively right along. As I understand it, CBS is getting some of the gear for its own use. And right now, the Navy is working out its plans for very extensive coverage in the Pacific.
That sounds like something pretty exciting. Maybe I could talk the boss into letting me go out there and look around and try out your fine little gadget. I'll return you now to Admiral in New York.
From Advanced Allied Headquarters in New Guinea comes word today that during June, we destroyed 247 Japanese planes, 5 destroyers, 14 merchantmen, and 95 barges in the Southwest Pacific Theater alone. These blows were dealt largely in support of the invasion of Biak on the Skouten Islands off North Dutch New Guinea, where General MacArthur's forces now have airfields in cooperation with bombing range of the Philippines. And now once again, here is Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral.
With a great amount of publicity being given to frequency modulation, television, and numerous other new ideas in radio, you're probably wondering if tomorrow's peacetime radio will bear any resemblance to your present set. Admiral Corporation has been a leader in research in television, radar, and FM. But we can tell you that many of the practical features of the pre-war Admiral will be retained. One of these is the Admiral Aeroscope. The Aeroscope is a built-in antenna incorporated right into the radio cabinet. It eliminates the fuss and bother of outside antennas and messy, unsightly ground wires. This Admiral-built, Admiral-engineered Aeroscope tends to reduce static and assures properly amplified sound waves with ample power and volume. Yes, you can expect many new ideas in your post-war Admiral, along with the best of the pre-war features that made Admiral the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonographs with automatic record changers. War costs money, a lot of money. The goal of the fifth war loan is $16 billion. This means an average of at least an extra $100 in cash invested in war bonds for every man, woman, and child in the United States. It's your chance to invest in invasion. Our boys in Normandy and the South Seas need your help. So let's back the attack. Buy more than before. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Admiral Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set, and post-war makers of Admiral refrigerators, Admiral home freezers, Admiral electric ranges. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
WBBM, Chicago. As your doctor judges it, no other aspirin can do more for you than genuine, pure St. Joseph aspirin. So next time a common headache strikes, take St. Joseph aspirin. It's the world's largest seller at 10 cents, 100 tablets, 35 cents. Demand St. Joseph aspirin.